Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and this is the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed in this program include transhumanism and issues of human enhancement, technology, futurism, astronomy, SETI and the search for extraterrestrial life, catastrophic risks, existentialism and spirituality, among many other things. So sit back and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, podcasting to you today on March the 6th, 2005. Some of the topics I hope to get to today include Nick Bostrom's existential risks argument, virtual reality and gaming and online worlds, and just how much that's taking off. And we'll do some projecting to think about where it might lead in the future. And as well to talk about the fine-tuning of the universe and the potential trajectory for the future of intelligent life. Hopefully I can squeeze all that in the next 15 to 20 minutes or so. Just some news quickly off the top. For those who are visiting my blog, Sentient Developments, you might notice that I've been reposting old columns of mine that I'd written for Better Humans. With all the upgrades with Better Humans recently, and even over time, oftentimes the permanent links that have been associated with my columns have been lost. And while I've restored them in the links section of my blog, I've decided I wanted to take a bit more ownership over permanent links, so I will systematically, over the course of the next little while, be posting every single one of my columns onto my Sentient Developments blog. So that's both good news and bad news. Hopefully you will enjoy my rereading my columns again, and I'm sorry if the repetitious columns or the even what might be considered older columns might be a bit of an annoyance, but I'd like to get that over and done with. Transhumanist philosopher Nick Bostrom is doing his best to try to save the world from annihilation and obviously trying to prevent the human species from meeting extinction. He has given much thought to the topic of existential risks, and he's probably the world's leading expert on the matter. And a number of years ago, he wrote a piece called Existential Risks: Analyzing Human Extinction Scenarios, where he systematically put down each and every conceivable risk that he thought was at least even moderately reasonable that could result in the extinction of the human species. Now, we're not talking about, you know, a local catastrophe or a small-scale disaster, even a large-scale disaster. What he's talking about is the big one, specifically human extinction. And he has subcategories of different types of human extinction. There's, you know, where we all would be all killed in one single disaster, or it could even be something a bit more sublime or subtle, like what he would categorize as being a whimper, where we would just kind of, you know, fade away into some undesirable in some undesirable way, be it, you know, through the advent of a totalitarian regime, or be it through you know, resource depletion or whatever. Anyways, writing in Global Agenda recently, Bostrom, again, trying to make his ideas accessible as possible and trying to get his ideas out there as much as possible. In the article, he talks about potential risks. Of course, he talks about the first ever existential risk, which is, the first ever man-made piece of technology that could result in our own extinction, and that, of course, being the nuclear weapons. Never before in human history have we really been able to wipe ourselves out, at least not as sweepingly as we could with nuclear weapons. But since then, we soon will have in the future a number of different types of technologies that will also potentially cause human extinction. And this is obviously probably about as a worrying trend as there ever gets in terms of, you know, worrying trends, and that is that human civilization is increasingly coming into possession of more and more pieces of technology that could result in its own extinction, and that's obviously the cause of great concern. Other things that Bostrom talks about includes a deliberately engineered pathogen, something that would be just absolutely brutally virulent and deadly. Particle accelerator experiment accidents, where some kind of experimental particle accelerator would create like a perfectly vacuous state, or even a micro black hole, which would result in the annihilation of the planet. Of course, molecular nanotechnology run amok, the so-called gray goo scenario, whether the gray goo, you know, would eat up the atmosphere or just take over the entire planet itself. These are things that the kinds of foresight activities we should probably think about. And another one, biggie, is that obviously singularitarians are concerned about, and anyone that's concerned about the advent of artificial superintelligence, and that is runaway superintelligence or poorly programmed superintelligence. In other words, an artificial intelligence that is either poorly programmed or is just malign or misguided or just beyond our control, and it would result in our destruction in some way. I mean, you can only imagine the different ways that could happen, and various science fiction scenarios have found no no dearth of fodder for their stories in terms of this scenario. Bostrom also talks about sociological catastrophes such as I mentioned earlier, the advent of a repressive totalitarian regime, or even a transhumanism that could lead to the stagnation and thorough debasement of human life. Some kind of, you know, we would engineer ourselves somehow to be less than human, not more than human, but less than human, and something that would eventually lead to the collapse of civilization, or even what we would value in terms of being both individuals and what we would value as a society. Now, Bostrom's not defeatist, though, and he's suggesting that some serious foresight and energy be put into the problem. He does his best in the article to try not to sound too pessimistic. He's basically suggesting that we can, in fact, engage in deliberate steps that we can engage in that will reduce many of the existential risks. And he talks about things like how we've successfully mapped potentially dangerous asteroids. There's things like this that he wants us to kind of think more about. And ultimately, he says, the challenge is neither to ignore the risks nor to indulge in gloomy despondency, but in his words, to seek understanding and to take the most cost-effective steps to make the world safer. It's been said that the more we learn about the universe, the more incomprehensible it becomes. I'm not one that actually agrees with that statement. If anything, the more we're learning about our universe, the more unbelievably detailed and specific it is. And what I'm referring to specifically is the fine-tuning argument, the idea that we're living in a very non-arbitrary universe. And as scientists are exploring more and more, and as they delve deeper and deeper into the unsolved mysteries of the universe, they're discovering that a number of cosmological parameters are excruciatingly specific. So specific, in fact, that any minor alteration to key parameters would throw the entire universe off kilter and result in a system completely unfriendly to life. There's a whole bunch of these parameters, or cosmological constants, whatever you want to call them, and I recommend you go check them out at Wikipedia. Go to the fine-tuning entry on Wikipedia, and you'll see there a whole list of different things that are so specific that even if they had been altered in the slightest amount, the universe really wouldn't exist, or life wouldn't exist in the universe. And again, we're not just talking about a decimal point here or a decimal point there. In some cases, it is obscenely specific. I'll go on in a minute just to describe some of that. But a number of people are having opinions about this and are converging around a kind of an idea. But before I get to that, some look at fine-tuning and look at that as evidence for there being a designer or a god. And that gives rise to teleological arguments like intelligent design. And others claim that, as I've mentioned before, the universe is spontaneously finely tuned. Now, there are several theories that try to explain why the universe is so finely tuned. First, there's anthropic observation in consideration of an ensemble of universes, and that was put together mainly by philosophers Carter and Leslie. What they suggest is that we are observing a universe that appears finely tuned because we would not be able to observe any other kind of universe, so that every single attribute that our universe exhibits, of course it's going to be there because we are observing such a universe, and that the parameters of the universe have created us observers. In other words, the universe is self-reflective, not by accident. excuse me. There's also Wheeler's participatory anthropic principle, where he kind of mixes in some the Copernican Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics into this, where he says that in the participatory anthropic principle, he implies that observers force the universe into existence. And I'm actually somewhat partial to that idea, that it's consciousness that is actually forcing the universe to exist and exhibit the characteristics that it has. And this is actually emitted from the infinite quantum realm. I find this most interesting. There's a famous quote from Wheeler. He says, "It from bit." You can imagine an infinite stream of bits, and it is created by a consciousness forcing it to exist. And finally, there, in terms of why there is a finely tuned universe, philosophers and scientists like Smolin and Smart have argued that it's actually natural selection that has endowed the universe with its particular characteristics. And they mean natural selection in a very literal way, that the universe is a replicative entity. It reproduces, and like any kind of system that reproduces, it's subject to selectional pressures. And in this case, the universe exhibits all the traits that it has because it has adopted them through the processes of natural selection. That, in other words, universes that are not viable will not exist, or at least universes that are not viable and not viable to have intelligent observers in them will not exist. Now, on this last point, that of natural selection, the obvious question is, if the universe is a replicating entity, and if its attributes are the result of natural selection, well, why must the universe also be so biophilic? Biophilic meaning, why is it so friendly to life? In other words, couldn't the physics of the universe develop such that it was merely a replicating entity that didn't necessarily have to support life? One possible answer, of course, is that there are many types of spontaneously replicating universes, some support life, some of which do not. In our case, we happen to be observing one universe, or the type of universe, that supports life, and our existence is completely irrelevant to the universe's life cycle. We just happen to be an artifact. We have nothing to do with the universe's existence. There are other universes that may not have life in them, and it's still replicative. This one happens to be both replicative and one that supports life, which is why we're observing it. However, a lot of people are not satisfied with that answer, and they believe that there is some kind of deeper meaning to the presence of life, and in particular, not just life, but intelligence and organizing civilizations. And one possible answer is that civilizations are, or advanced intelligences are, part of the replicative process. Freeman Dyson once wrote, he says, "The more I examine the universe and study the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known that we were coming. There are some striking examples in the laws of nuclear physics of numerical accidents that seem to conspire to make the universe habitable." Now, I first encountered this argument through John Smart, and he called it the developmental singularity, or the developmental singularity hypothesis, and he suggests that advanced intelligences may spawn new baby universes soon after the technological singularity event. And more recently, I read an article on Kurzweil AI by a gentleman by the name of James Gardner, and he argues for what he calls the selfish biocosm hypothesis. Now, Gardner's argument is quite interesting. He writes that two recent discoveries have imparted a kind of a new sense to look into the anthropic qualities of our cosmos. And specifically, the value of dark energy density is unbelievably small, but not quite zero, and the number of different solutions permitted by M-theory is astronomical, measured not in millions or billions, but in Googles or Googleplexes. Again, what he's suggesting is that the universe is finely tuned to the point of absurdity. And according to Gardner's theory, the laws and constants of physics function as the cosmic equivalent of DNA. I find that unbelievably interesting, that the physics of the universe is its DNA. It guides a cosmologically extended evolutionary process and provides a blueprint for the replication of new life-friendly progeny universes. And as Gardner notes, theories of cosmological eschatology have previously been articulated by Kurzweil, Wheeler, and Dyson, all of whom they've essentially predicted that, if I can quote Gardner, the ongoing process of biological and technological evolution is sufficiently robust and unbounded that, in the far distant future, a cosmologically extended biosphere could conceivably exert a global influence on the physical state of the cosmos. In fact, there are some cosmologists, and I can think of namely Milan Sirkovich. He's argued that the universe's life cycle, or this field is referred to as cosmological eschatology, it should not be studied without reference to the influence of intelligent life. So you can't just keep, you know, looking at the universe as something that's going to have a big bang and then have an end stage. Without thinking, well, what kind of interventions our intelligence is going to invoke on the universe's life cycle? And already, look at the planet Earth, for example. When we are now officially, for better or for worse, these days it seems for worse, we are a force of nature on planet Earth. We are definitely contributing quite significantly to this planet. And one can perhaps infer that eventually civilizations will extend and start to impact on the universe or engage in universe engineering or re-engineering, probably Kardashev 3-scale type intelligences. Now, what Gardner talks about is what intelligences do in conjunction with their advancing technologies, that they will act as von Neumann controllers. So you and I are von Neumann controllers, or rather, the emergent qualities of our civilization and intelligence will be a von Neumann controller within a cosmologically extended biosphere, and will function and the universe itself will function as a von Neumann duplicator in this hypothesized process of cosmological replication. And I find this unbelievably interesting, and I hope that more work is done on this in the future. Maybe, you know, we'll find that humans are a complete blip in the universe and have no purpose and other, you know, purpose than just being here. Or we might find that civilizations, in fact, will advance to some unbelievable stage and start to contribute to the universe's life cycle. If this is the case, by the way, the latter, that in terms of addressing the Fermi paradox of wondering where everybody is, other civilizations, the only way this will really work, based on our observations, is that the universe is about to go through a phase transition, meaning that we live in an extraordinarily special time in the history of the universe, that prior to this time, intelligences have really, the conditions to allow intelligences to arise have not existed. And only in recent cosmological terms, timescales, have intelligences been able to develop to the point where they will emerge and become sophisticated and complex enough to be in communication with other intelligences across the galaxy and in the universe, and basically start to take over the universe. Whew, boy, just thinking about that gives me goosebumps. But anyways, we will we'll have to see if our science can figure that out. MMORPGs, or massive multiplayer online role-playing games, are starting to become very, very popular. And by consequence of their popularity, they're becoming also extremely sophisticated. Virtual worlds can, they now have such things as retailers, like shopkeepers that sell avatars or, you know, different, you know, things that basically, you know, there, an economy has been created in these virtual worlds, and an economy meaning scarcity, that you can't automatically get what you want for free, either because you're not skilled enough or because you don't know how to get it. So you have to go about getting it through shopkeepers or retailers and procuring them in the virtual world. There are such things now in the virtual world as thieves, prostitutes. You can even find some married couples. And there's even genocidal war criminals, which is completely ridiculous. But if I'll call up the reference here, let's see if I can find this here. There was in Korea a game called Legion. Players engage in a virtual genocide of Chinese players after they were discovered stealing virtual money and objects and selling them on the internet for real cash. How ridiculous is that? But there you go. With MMORPGs, there are some communities that have as many as 6 million subscribers. That's unbelievable. 6 million, that's a massive city unto itself. And needless to say, academics are starting to take notice, and they're studying the economics and psychology of players in these virtual worlds. And you even have rumors that the IRS are thinking of even, you know, starting to tax citizens or even those who play, or you know, if there's commerce happening, to tax the commerce happening within the virtual worlds. Not surprisingly, computer addiction is starting to become a real problem. Last fall, a Chinese girl died after playing for several days straight and completely neglecting her health. Others stay at home from work. They lie about their jobs. They spend too much of their leisure time in front of the machines and so forth. And most interesting, clearly, these massive multiplayer games are here to stay. And one can only marvel at how an entirely new realm of existence, really, has emerged as a result of computer technology. In a sense, computers have spawned this whole new alternate dimension of reality, this new place to be. And thinking into the future, I wonder just how far virtual worlds will go and what role virtual reality will play in all this. I can imagine, for example, future MMORPGs that are fully immersive. So you're not so much looking at an avatar on the screen as you are the avatar. Thinking kind of like a Matrix-like brainjack role-playing game. And I can imagine that such a game would have both active and passive personalities. An active personality meaning that you are yourself, in control of your character, and a passive personality meaning that it's a completely computer-generated entity, both in terms of its appearance and its psychology. So it's an automaton. There's no it has qualities of a psychology, but there's no real psychology behind its actions. I also have to think that there's going to be the line that divides the simulations and the MMORPGs will eventually start to blur. So simulations will start to kind of integrate in with the role-playing world. In other words, watching Sims and SimCity will start to kind of wear thin, and you'll want to actually be in there, in amongst them, in with them, as you set up the parameters. And given the potential for human-machine interfaces and the future of computing, perhaps future existence will be entirely entailed by persons living multiple existences across many different virtual worlds. Given that the virtual world will eventually meet the real world in terms of realism and intricacy, it's possible that what we regard as individuality today will become a thing of the past. There won't be one you so much as there will be multiple yous, and each and every one of them a legitimate existence in their own right. And I think of this, for example, as a very real and possible way in which post-humans will engage in life and in existence. I think of this as being their recreational or leisure time, or even simply their preferred mode of existence. We'll be living across multiple realities across different types of individuals. It makes you wonder, of course, if our current reality isn't the same sort of deal, where there's actually a deeper reality in play here, that of the post-human engaging in simulations or virtual reality type of activities. but our psychologies are suppressed. We don't know beyond our own. We don't know who we are beyond our own existence. Again, kind of like, you know, Matrix type stuff, but certainly not within the realm of theoretic possibility. If you like this sort of thing, I highly recommend an essay by Barry Dainton called Innocence Lost: Simulation Scenarios, Prospects, and Consequences. And there's my own column from a number of years ago called Welcome to the Unreal World, and you can catch the links on my blog, Sentient Developments. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's program. That's it for today, and I always welcome feedback, as usual. Please visit my blog and to catch up on all the latest that I am writing about. Until next time, have a very pleasant evening. Bye-bye.